there's this fear there. And I think that that fear is one of the really sinister things about colonialism that it does to Indigenous people, yes, but also non-Indigenous people, is that it really instills everybody, I think, with this mindset of scarcity and of violence, and it really keeps us trapped there.
The world has been transformed by colonialism,
but not irreparably so.
This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Far more than a hashtag or metaphor, land back has become a powerful theory of change, a radical remembering of what's possible for our communities and nations if we commit to fully unraveling the systems of harm and domination that characterize settler societies in North America and around the world. I believe that land back is a prerequisite for truly solving global environmental problems like climate change. But land back is also frequently mischaracterized and misunderstood. To remedy this, I am speaking today with Riley Yesno. Riley is an Anishinaabe scholar and writer, a Vanier scholar, and a research fellow at the Yellowhead Institute. Riley and I talk about the basics of land back, about how it sits at the center of a tapestry of initiatives for Indigenous healing and resurgence, and about the futures we might imagine if we shed the fear and lack of imagination that colonialism is constantly whispering in our ears. Let's dig in. Joining me for this episode to talk about the land back movement is Riley Yesno, an Anishinaabe scholar and writer from the Abmatung First Nation in what is now known to many as Central Ontario. I first heard Riley speak on this topic for a local news magazine program and knew I had to have her on the show. Riley, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Maybe we can start right at the beginning to get everybody up to speed to where you and I might be in this conversation. Can you give us a short primer on the land back movement?
Sure. So maybe to start from the very beginning, land back came onto the scene. It was first, articulated in 2018. Not by, an individual Indigenous person at an event or a government or an academic paper. It came from Instagram and from a Blackfoot meme creator named Arnell Tailfeathers. And the meme was basically getting across this idea, like when somebody says to you, your partner says to you or something, oh yeah, land back, like I'm going to give you the land back. And that's like a really exciting, almost flirtatious thing to say. And among Indigenous people, it went viral, and it was something everybody thought was so funny, but also, spoke to politics that we all really cared about. And so it took off, and you started to see land back appear in a lot of sort of commercial spaces. So like a tribe called Red, I believe they're now called the Hallucination. They released a song called Land Back, and all of the proceeds from that song were going to the Wet'suwet'en land defenders out west. You saw artists make, patches and signs and all these things. Oh, sorry if you can hear the sirens. I'm downtown. They started to make patches and signs and all these things that said Land Back on them. And so people were wearing Land Back on their bodies. And really, really quickly, it started to evolve into this like more thoroughly articulated idea. And so the Yellowhead Institute created the Land Back Report, which they released in 2019, which gave some examples of what land back in action looks like, how Indigenous people are doing land back every day. And, it's now something that in 2021, we saw a Canadian politician, Mark Miller, use for the first time, which caused another level of debate into this topic. So that's kind of how the trajectory came, how it grew. One of the things that I think is really cool about it, right, is that it's completely decentralized. Nobody owns land back. There's no set definition of what it is. So it can mean something a little bit different to different people. But I think what binds all of its uses is this real spirit of Indigenous resurgence. The definition that I use, land back would be any action that supports affirming or returning jurisdiction, authority, and resources, especially those that have been attacked by colonization, putting those back into the hands of Indigenous people. And those might be individual actions, but ultimately they serve a larger common goal, which is securing Indigenous sovereignty and liberation from settler colonial domination.
I've been reflecting a lot in a lead up to this conversation with you about the kinds of questions and confusions I encounter when I talk to other settlers about land back. There's often this sort of, well, you know, what happens to us reaction. And a handful of episodes ago in this show, I was speaking to Dr. Kelsey Leonard from the Shinnecock First Nation. And she says a lot of people misunderstand this as thinking that it's an effort to take something away, when it's in fact an effort to put something back. And that really struck me. And I'm curious to hear what you think about that characterization.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really beautiful and really succinct way to put it. I think the reason why, you know, that there's often, and I hear it all the time too, this like apprehension around land back as if it's like, I don't know, some ethno-national project or something where, you know, Indigenous people basically displace non-Indigenous people in the same way that, you know, happened at colonization. And there's this fear there. And I think that that fear is one of the really sinister things about colonialism that it does to Indigenous people, yes, but also non-Indigenous people, is that it really instills everybody, I think, with this this mindset of scarcity and of violence. And it really keeps us trapped there. So your initial thought is, what does this mean for me? Is it going to cause me harm? As opposed to, you know, what can I gain from this? What could be made more out of this? And I do think that that's what land back is about. Yes, it's this ethical obligation or a moral obligation because Indigenous people face violence from colonization and that has to be undone. But also Indigenous people pursue this because we know and believe that that project is for the betterment, not just of our own nations, but for everybody. And we want to see futures with better relations between us, between the earth, and so much more. So it's supposed to be about adding as opposed to taking things away from people.
Thanks for that answer. And also, I appreciate how excited you are in talking about this. And that's sort of my way of getting back to talking about practical examples that make you excited, that fuel that excitement, even one that maybe we can learn from about what's next and how to support and how to proceed.
Yeah. Maybe the one thing about land back that I hope people, like, if they take something away, is that I think they sometimes think it's like this project only for like elites. Like, you have to have land to be able to give it back, right? And is what this idea I think is. And I'm like, that's a very small portion of people that have land and disposable land that they can give back and all of these things. But in fact, like, it's also those everyday actions of just respecting Indigenous people's authority and jurisdiction. So like, for example, when Indigenous people, you know, have protocols on their territories, I'm thinking, you know, even something small, like out west, there's a nation that has protocols in place about how people can pick and forage mushrooms on their territory. So these are obviously not enforced by Canadian courts, but they are, you know, laws that the nation has set out. And if they say, if you want to be on the territory, you have to respect them. And so non-Indigenous people who come onto these lands, respecting those laws as if they were, you know, Canadian sovereign laws, is a way of affirming, like, yes, we recognize these are your lands. These are your territories. You get to decide how we interact with them. And so it can be simply as like, you know, yeah, doing that when you pick your mushrooms. And there's some other cool stuff too. Like in lots of places, especially in the States, people like pay rent almost to Indigenous people, where they give monthly or annually amounts of money that goes into a trust so that Indigenous people can continue to live on that land for next generations. And it's so there's creative and really accessible ways that everybody can sort of join the project.
So in my experience working with people who are trying really interesting, different, innovative things on the ground, there's also key barriers and key next steps. Mm-hmm. If you had to pick one thing that you feel like, if we could change this thing that's really holding us back, this movement would take off even more.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I'm thinking of two things. One is probably we already sort of touched on, which is like this real fear of upending the status quo. And I think that that's a fear that like Canada really is invested in all of us having. Mm-hmm. And so there's considerable work done, I think, to make it seem A, like they're already doing enough. Why would we have to do something so radical? Like, you know, give them, we're doing reconciliation, you know, this sort of narrative. And I think that's one thing to be really, really critical of. And once we do, we start to see the holes and say, okay, something else is necessary. And also, I think that it's like this really stunting of the colonial imagination again. Like Canada's a baby country. It's 150 years old, a little bit over, you know? That's only like a couple generations of grandparents ago. Mm-hmm. And if like those people didn't think it was too wild to build a country, why is it so radical to think that we could, you know, revolutionarily change ours? And so that opening again of what is possible makes changes like land back seem tangible in a way that I think it's hard for people right now. So that's one. The other thing is that I think Indigenous people living in a country where we know that there's an active genocide going on have to spend basically every day like trying to survive. And we don't have as much time as I think we do or we need to be able to imagine and pursue those alternate futures. I think we get like, it's a really sad thing where I think so many people, because of how much harm is inflicted on us on a daily basis, their wildest dreams about what the future can be are just healing. And we don't get the time or space to think about those possibilities beyond healing into thriving. What does those alternate futures look like for us? What are we working towards?
I agree with you and I appreciate that answer. And the honesty and reality about, there's a big difference between being resilient and healing and thriving and looking forward. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out in this conversation that it's, you know, May the 5th. This is a month of remembering, a day of remembering for murdered and missing Indigenous women. And for the listeners, you're wearing striking red beaded dress earrings. And I wonder if you have any thoughts or anything you would like to say or share related to the significance of the day and also how that links broader to this bigger conversation about resurgence.
Yeah. So I like when we say land back, I think, you know, we say land, but not in the way that like Western capitalist Europeans understand land as like property and just like a thing to have because there's power associated with it. Like land to us is like, you know, much, it means something much more. And it means like our relationship to each other. We are told our land and our lives and our nations all come from women. It's tied to that. Aki, Mother Earth we have. So like land is really tied to gender relations, to language. And so when we say land back, it doesn't mean just like the physical space. It also means that a reclamation of the role that women and queer people had in our nations prior to colonization. It means like a dismantlement of heteropatriarchal, you know, ideas of how society should be structured. Land back is more fulsome than just like, you know, acres. And so that's something I really think about. And as like a queer Anishinaabe person myself, like I also am critical but appreciative of the way that the red dress even has come to symbolize murdered and missing. Because, you know, this association with dresses and skirts and all these things with being women, that's a very colonial way of understanding, you know, who a woman is and what women means. And I'm so thankful for the work of, you know, Jamie Black, Christy Belcourt, who made this project happen. And it's not to disparage their work in any way, because they launched this conversation in a way that nobody had before them. That at a time when Canada was explicitly hostile about this idea of approaching MMIWG like they have now. But I also think it's really important to be critical about like, where do these ideas and associations with femininity come from? And like, how does that limit us? And so reclaiming those ways of understanding gender and sexuality are also part of this project, I think, and necessary. Like, if we get the land back, we better be able to like understand gender in a way better way than Canada has, you know?
Yeah, I understand, and I appreciate that you're asking us to push this conversation to a little bit more fundamental level. And that seems, on the one hand, big and daunting, but on the other hand, seems really exciting and both literally and figuratively liberating. And so I appreciate that. And it really links well to where I was hoping to take this conversation next. You're talking about very big changes, radical changes, which is what this podcast seeks to be about. And we also face radical problems, climate change, you know, the colonial problems that are being experienced globally. There's all these big issues of environmental justice. And whilst a number of people have been making arguments that these are social problems, not technological, that you solve these problems by addressing equity, justice, rights. But I'm hearing this imperialism of urgency. Mm. And now we're at this point where the problems are too big, the impacts are too close, that yeah, social change would be great, but we don't have time for that. So let's go build nuclear, or let's go build carbon capture and storage, or whatever the tech fix is. And I guess the question that's in here for you is how can we help people see major radical social change like land back, not as a barrier or something that's going to slow everything down, but as something that's going to accelerate how we solve these problems?
Yeah. I like the overlaps between climate justice and Indigenous justice. Like, it's a common phrase I think I encounter in communities that they're like one in the same, right? Like that you can't have without one without the other. The thing when I tell people that I can see like something click in their brains a little bit when I say it is like, how Indigenous people, this is a stat from the UN Biodiversity Commission, that they represent like 5% of the total global population. Indigenous people protect over 80% of the entire world's biodiversity. And also Indigenous resistance against carbon last year put out a report that said in North America alone, well, just Canada and the US, that Indigenous people's direct action protests, often in the name of land back, like 1492 Land Back Lane, the land back protests of Mount Rushmore, those actions have mitigated up to 25% of GHG emissions annually. And so it's like, you know, you want to talk about like the work that needs to be done. Indigenous people are already doing it, and they're doing it with like very little population, with no support really from the public at large, no funding, and still are doing more to mitigate climate change every year than, you know, solar panels could really ever do for us, or, you know, things like that. And so you can only imagine what if we could give as much urgency as we do to like creating these massive technologies as we do to people who already have the solutions or are already embodying the solutions, what transformative change could come about. I think that would be wild.
I absolutely agree. And earlier, you know, it links back to what you said earlier, that Indigenous peoples are already in the midst of having to cope with so much enduring harm, historical legacies of harm, but also ongoing structural inequity, genocide. So yeah, how could we free up some resources and support the people who are already doing the most? I really appreciate that answer. It makes me think, and you mentioned earlier the Yellowhead Institute, and I know that you're a fellow with the Yellowhead Institute. In addition to the land back paper that they put out, they also put one called Cash Back. And it's such an interesting, I think, compelling pair. I wondered if maybe you could just say a little bit about that as well, what that means.
You know, Canada's wealth and its power is built off of the resources that they stole from the lands that they also stole. And so part of it is, or a huge part of it is not just like, yeah, we have the land back, but that we also have the resources back and the power that comes with having those resources back as well. Because those are necessary parts of building up our capacity to be the nations that we could have been if it had not been for the interruption of colonialism. And cashback also, I realized, showed me that I got really stuck up in what these like Western conceptualizations of economies had to be also. It had to be like this, you know, stock markety, like resources investing type stuff. And they have a whole section in cashback dedicated to like, you know, what do economies of care look like? What do economies where the whole interaction and all of the reciprocity is based on people making sure that other Indigenous people are thriving, because we recognize that in turn, that means our whole nations thrive. And that is somebody's whole labor in the way that, you know, you working for your paycheck is. And that idea to me, I was like, oh yeah, I really got stuck, you know, in what Canada tells you that an economy has to look like and be and feel like. And so there was something also really transformative about, I think, what they say, you know, cash is, what the power associated with cash looks like.
That's I'm glad that you brought us there. That's such an important thing to recognize. This isn't about asking to fill up everybody's spending accounts. This is about reclaiming the wealth that was extracted and stolen over a period of time. It happens to take the form of cash in an economy that's so organized around wealth and value as money, as currency. But economies can be very different and have multiple different kinds of value that people can share and exchange. I have one more question that I want to ask you, and I ask everybody this. What is a radical change that you'd like to see unfold in your lifetime? And how close are we?
That's a good question. I see why you ask everyone it. I think maybe is like the scope of thinking. And what I mean by that is like one of the things I really loved about Indigenous teachings that guide me in my work is like a thinking that, you know, here in the present, we are like the smallest part of the picture, actually, that like everything behind us that brought us here and everything that's going to come, especially, are the things where we need to have all of our focus and all of our weight. You know, some people call it like the seven generations teaching. There's like a whole bunch of different ways of thinking about it. But this idea that the present is in service of the future and in reverence of the past is something that like, yeah, like when I'm having a bad day that I'm like, you know, what is that bad day in the scope of like these long worlds we're trying to build? And so I think that we understand that to a certain extent, like I think everybody inherently might think about, you know, their children or like what their grandparents did for them. But like to be able to think beyond that is super easy, actually, but it takes a deliberate amount of intention and of unlearning. Like the reason, of course, that we can only think immediately in front of us and immediately behind us is because of that concept of like the nuclear family, right? Like that the only thing that really matters is you and then your immediate circles. And Indigenous people have always understood that an injustice against one of us is an injustice against all of us, that our kin extend far beyond our household walls. And so, yeah, there's elements of it there that I think are already innate in people. And I think that there are models of it that Indigenous people already have and articulations of it. And it's just a matter of embracing it. And that's like one that if we could do, I think the changes that would spur because of that change in mindset would be revolutionary.
I really appreciate that answer. Thank you for that. And thanks for taking a little bit of time today to talk to me.
Yeah, thank you, Miigwech, for having me. I love getting to talk about the future.
Thanks for joining us. Today, I spoke with Riley Yesno, a research fellow with the Yellowhead Institute. Information about Riley and her work is available in the episode notes. This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional and treaty lands of the Mississaugas of the Credit. The Second Transition Podcast is produced with support from the Arrow Food Institute and Voice Ed Radio. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.